note.
Everybody in Seattle wants to know, why did that officer hassle the man with the golf club? Why? Good Friday to you. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Give us 1 hour, and we're going to give you something to talk about this weekend as we review the week's news. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Welcome, Eli.
Nice to be here.
Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel and contributor to Bloomberg View. Hi, Joni.
Good to see you, Bill.
And you. And, of course, the Mossback at crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine columnist Knute Berger. Hi there.
Hey, Bill.
So let's get into our top story. How long have we been talking about the way police treat especially African Americans, not just in Ferguson, Missouri, or New York City, but in Seattle, where the SPD is under federal supervision for biased policing? This week, Seattle police said they have apologized to a 69-year-old man at the time, arrested last summer after refusing an officer's commands to drop a golf club he was carrying on a Capitol Hill sidewalk. The officer claims this man, William Wingate, aggressively swung the golf club at her police car and missed, so she turned around and yelled at him to set the golf club down. He asks what's going on, and she won't tell him. She just keeps yelling, "Set it down." Finally, she says, "Why?
You just swung that golf club at me."
"I did not."
"Yes, you did, right back there."
"I didn't see you on the window, golf club."
"It was on audio and videotape. Put it down."
He still won't put it down. He keeps telling her to call someone. And KUOW asked Wingate why.
I was afraid. I was scared because I didn't know what she was going to do. I didn't know what was going to happen to me.
Well, what happened to him is he was arrested and spent the night in jail. His lawyers want at least $750,000 in damage. The NAACP wants the officer fired. Eli, I said that the SPD apologized. Do you know what exactly they apologized for?
I haven't heard that. The SPD has said that they apologized to him sometime last summer or late last summer and brought his golf club back and returned it to him, but I didn't hear the specifics of what the apology was for.
Did the officer do anything illegal that we know of?
Nothing that's been determined to be illegal, but it appears that he was arrested without cause. I mean, you cannot tell from the video why he was arrested. The officer claims you swung that golf club at me, as people just heard, and she also says the video will support this. But you watch the video, and there is no evidence of him swinging the golf club at her.
Well, at one point during the incident, she says, "I'm stopping the recording now because I'm going to go back and see if it actually was caught on video." I mean, she might have seen what she thought was him swinging a golf club, and she might have been mistaken. Maybe she thought it was on video and it wasn't.
Well,
we don't know.
Well, this is interesting,
right?
Though, because if during the process of the arrest she stopped the video, went back, and looked for video evidence of him swinging the golf club at her, she would have found that there is no video evidence because the SPD released all the video of this encounter. And so even after she looked at the video and presumably found no evidence, he was arrested. He was booked into jail. There's a heartbreaking moment where you see him getting into the back of a paddy wagon, and he's 69 years old at the time. He can't even get in. An officer has to kind of kick a stool over so that he can climb in, and he just sits there looking bewildered.
Right.
So I'm thinking about this in sort of a broader sense. It seemed when all the things happened in Ferguson, and you had your mayor come out and say, "We are not Ferguson," it seemed that Seattle sort of had already sort of dealt with some of this, certainly not all of it, because here we go again. But
well, now, wait a minute. I mean, first of all, obviously we're not talking about lethal force,
but do we
even know that this had anything to do with race?
Well, the reason we think it had something to do with race had to do with what happened afterwards,
yes,
which has to do with a Facebook posting, which I can't quote verbatim. Perhaps you have it in front of you.
I do, of course. Let's see. This officer, have we named her yet? Officer Whitlatch?
Yes, her name is out there.
She did write on Facebook about this idea that black men are disproportionately targeted by police, and she was very dismissive of that. She said, calling it black people's paranoia that white people are out to get them. She says, if you believe that blacks are not accusing white America for their problems, then you're missing the point of the riots in Ferguson and the chronic black racism that far exceeds any white racism in this country. And she goes on.
So my point here is that, you know, look, we have a brand new police chief, very popular, Chief Kathleen O'Toole, comes in, says she's a reformer. She's all about unbiased policing, some of the things that were under the federal thumb about. And this is really her first test since she's come here because, Yes, there were the rallies that followed Ferguson and the event in New York, but Seattle hadn't had an event like this since she has been the chief. And so you knew it was a honeymoon type time. You knew an event would come right in front of her. And so she is now being tested. She and the mayor met yesterday. They are taking this very seriously. And it is the combination of two things. It is indeed the event, whatever it was, with this swinging or not swinging golf club, mixed with the Facebook postings. And so there is a social media component to this that is quite fascinating.
Canute, you and I were talking about how baffling it is just what happened that day and why. For example, let's even say that this officer really is concerned with how you can't hassle an African American without a bunch of accusations. Why would she go to such pains to just get right out of the car and start yelling at this guy to put the golf club down without telling him why? And then just, you know, it's a golf club. And if whatever happened had happened quite a while ago, he's just standing there leaning on it. I don't even understand why there was this interaction.
Well, you know, one of the emphasis that the department has been trying to instill in people is the idea of de-escalation of events. And this sounds like a classic example of an officer escalating events, taking something that could be perceived as very normal. And that perception of threat really goes to a lot of, you know, basic fears that people have, often about race or whatever. I keep thinking about the people that took guns into the galleries in Olympia and how they've been banned from doing this now. You can't carry an open weapon into a hearing room, for example. And the state patrol said, you know, well, we would stop that person and ask them politely to leave. And there was a kind of a whole process short of wrestling them to the ground and shooting them. There are a lot of citizens in this country that don't get that step. They don't get that courtesy of de-escalation or having an option of not being a threat. So this whole thing embodies some of the very issues that we're all wrestling with nationally, as well as particularly here in Seattle, which has to do with that kind of internalized racism. And here you have an officer who's expressing these thoughts on social media, who's had other incidents. And it's an important, now we have film to look at, and we're going to have more film in the future. So in a sense, this is like a test case of how is the department going to respond to this stuff.
And I think it's worth just throwing in there, I'm not sure if we've said this in the discussion yet, but the reason Wingate says he had a golf club is because he uses it as a cane.
Right.
A walking stick.
He's been carrying this thing around supposedly for 20 years. People in the neighborhood know him.
Right. It was given to him by a neighbor friend who saw he needed a cane, is what he says. And the video supports this. He's just standing there on the corner using the golf club as a cane.
I guess maybe we know why. This is the point. Like, I'm not used to getting hassled and feeling really scared when a police officer walks up. But if an officer tells me to drop the golf club, first I'm going to set the golf club down and then say, what's going on? You know, I mean, this interaction goes on and on and on with this guy not complying.
Well,
and it sounds like he's...
That's a good point, because I'm a little different from you, perhaps, because if somebody told me to drop a golf club, I'd probably just drop the golf club and then figure it out.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
To be clear. Okay.
But we all have different experiences, don't we?
Yeah, I think we would maybe go back to Knut's point. Like, the people who want to open carry in the state legislature, if you come to them and say, put your gun down, you'll have a long discussion with them about their civil rights and their constitutional rights and so on. And they're not going to just drop it without being forced to. And they have a privilege of not feeling that their life is in threat while they have that discussion. Two, this man is 69 years old. So think back over the history that he's lived through. One of the people advocating on behalf of him said, this is amazing. He's a 69-year-old man who has never gotten in trouble with the law before, but has had a lot of experience of racist interactions with people throughout his life. He was a Metro bus driver. He was a military vet. And so he's walking through the city, and someone tells him to drop his cane, right? His
right.
Club cane. He is perfectly within his rights on a public sidewalk to say why.
Is he within his rights to not put the golf club down when an officer tells him to?
That particular bit of the law, I don't know, but it doesn't seem unreasonable to say, call someone.
Yes.
Call someone.
Yes. Call someone for backup, because who knows what's going to happen. That's what he said.
And he also looks legitimately confused.
Yes.
It's like, he can't quite hear her. What's going on? I didn't swing this at you.
And to bring this back to the bigger picture, this is what this man, William Wingate, says now. At KOW, talked to him about, I started this conversation with the bigger issue, SPD's under a federal orders, and there's Ferguson in New York City, and this is what William Wingate had to say about that.
I understand now what a lot of people are saying, you know, about the police department. And I understand it now more so than before, because I'm a victim. I'm a black man walking down the street, and I haven't done anything.
So it seems like he's fitting this into this bigger question. So my final question for you, we're going to move on. We have lots of other things to talk about. Are all of you agreed that this incident says something bigger and important about the Seattle Police Department, or is this just a one-off? People react sometimes in strange ways.
I'll tell you what it is. The way things had sort of quieted down specifically for Seattle made me think that there had been some changes in the officer training that were actually starting to be the reality on the street. And the escalation rather than de-escalation in this particular case says, you know, it didn't get through in this case. It did not affect this particular officer. So what are you guys doing? How is that de-escalation training going?
Eli?
I think it does say something more broadly about the department, and Mayor Murray agrees. He said yesterday, clearly we have more work to do. He takes this as a symbol of broader work that needs to be done. And just the fact that she was able to exist in the department as someone posting the things on Facebook that she was posting, and this is since last fall or winter, says that there is a problem there with what people feel they're allowed to do and what the oversight is.
Anything to add, Knut?
I just want to say one issue that I haven't heard addressed, and this is a kind of a bigger picture issue, is we talk about how there's no mental health safety net, and so a lot of people on the streets are acting out. I think this also applies to police officers. In other words, that there's often when law enforcement, there's a stigma about going to see a counselor to deal with the sort of daily traumas that police officers experience, which I think can heighten their their reactivity. And of course, you want police officers to be highly reactive when there's actual danger. And so it's a difficult thing to negotiate. But I also think that officers need support. They need ways of working through issues, race issues, fear issues, all kinds of things. And I'd love to see some sort of active program there and destigmatization of mental health counseling and that kind of thing for law enforcement.
This is KOW's Week in Review. Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. So as we said, this man, William Wingate's lawyers, are looking for damages. The police chief has said she will review this officer's performance. The NAACP wants her fired. We will continue to follow this for you on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. And we're back with the Week in Review in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knut Berger, and me, Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Now, as we review the top stories this week, we're not going to dwell on Bertha a bunch today for a change, but a short update. This week, two Republican state senators filed a bill to stop the tunnel project and keep a viaduct. What? Joni, are they serious?
What? Well, here's the situation here. You have one of them is from Ferndale and Whatcom County. The other who filed this bill is from Spokane. And to me, it was just some good old red meat, anti-Seattle red meat, because this thing was dead just about as quickly as it happened. I was in Olympia this week, and I was sitting with State Representative Ross Hunter, who, you know, budget guy, and I said something about this, and he goes, well, you know, so what? I could write a bill that moves Whatcom County to Canada, and it would have about as much impact as this one.
Okay.
We should note that this bill is going nowhere.
Absolutely nowhere.
The bill to kill Bertha, as we called it at The Stranger, has been killed. It won't get a hearing in committee.
Okay.
And that's a Republican senator who killed it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there's a you know, one of the areas of some bipartisan support are Republicans and Democrats both supporting the Department of Transportation. But I think this bill is indicative of some of the cynicism that's been generated by botched projects or projects that are problematic. A lot of the things that Senator Bumgartner was saying about his bill, he was co-sponsor of it, are things that you hear people in Seattle say every
right.
day. You know, it's a money pit, quit while, you know, et cetera. So it's not going to have an effect. But I think it suggests that those people who think that the issue of cost overruns or whatnot, if that ever gets back to the legislature, that Seattle being completely safely off the hook is probably not something you can rely on.
Okay. So this bill went nowhere. This bill went 1,000 feet.
Or 926.
That's 70% depends on how you... done, if you ask Tim Burgess.
Okay, elsewhere. If Governor Inslee wanted to abolish the death penalty, maybe he found a way to do it. About a year ago, Inslee put a moratorium on executions while he's in office. This week, in Olympia, state lawmakers introduced a bill to abolish the death penalty completely. Now, some of those sponsors are the usual death penalty opponents, no surprise. But some lawmakers calling for this are law and order conservatives who say, we don't pity the inmates, we don't like this temporary moratorium that we're in where the victims' families are stuck in limbo. They don't know whether the person who killed their loved one is going to pay with his life or he won't. So there is some bipartisan support to this. Knut, do you think Washington will abolish the death penalty like 18 other states have done?
Well, it's interesting. You're certainly seeing the politics of it shift and people, more and more leaders coming out almost unified against it. You've got the governor, the mayor of Seattle, and others, and Republicans as well in the legislature. There are problems with the way there seems to be racial bias to some degree in aggravated murder convictions and sentencing. So there's some questions there. Some people question the cost. You know, there's sort of a whole lot of factors. My problem isn't necessarily with the death penalty itself, in that, you know, we don't execute that many people. And most of the, you know, the nine people on death row, all of them seem like they deserve to be there. They're, you know, murders mainly of women and children and, you know, and the fellow who strangled the female jail guard up at Monroe. I mean, so, one question is, do the people on death row who are currently there, do they deserve to have their sentences carried out? The governor won't do it. The other question is, long term, does it make sense? Does it make economic sense, moral sense, and all that? And I think we're ready for a conversation. The voters of Washington wanted the death penalty reinstated. It was reinstated in 1993, or the executions commenced then. I think there have been, you know, less than half a dozen executions since then. We went for 30 years where the death penalty was frozen. We essentially weren't sending people to death row. So I'd like to see it go to the voters. I think it's a perfect thing to ask the voters about.
Yeah, I've been wondering whether that is the end game here, that they talk about it in the legislature, it doesn't actually go anywhere, but it's kicked to the voters as a referendum to the people. I also find it interesting, you know, Knut talked about the economic argument and the moral argument. It seems like the safer ground here actually is the discussion of the economic argument, at least for legislators, and that's where they can come together. The economic argument is so compelling. It's so obvious, the incredible drain on resources that pursuing the death penalty creates. And so Republicans and Democrats can both look at that and say, well, could we spend our money better? Could we save money by just pursuing life in prison? Yes.
Yeah, I think it was just this week the Seattle University came out with this study finding that aggravated murder prosecutions where the death penalty is sought cost $1 million more than cases where capital punishment was not pursued.
And that was reflected in the letter from the city council. You know, the attitudes on this are changing. I mean, it's obvious, you know, for example, the Seattle Times editorial page used to support the death penalty. They changed. You have bipartisan, in some cases, in the legislature. In the Senate, it was a technically bipartisan, but the Republican who was in on that, Mark Malosha, is a very conservative Democrat who was a very conservative Democrat last year and this year became a Republican. He's just very pro-life, if anybody's ever talked to Mark Malosha. I have. So you have all this change, basically, in attitudes, and you have a pretty overwhelming seconding of the idea of getting rid of the death penalty from the city attorney, the mayor, all nine members of the city council in that letter. You know, just basically saying, you know, we could do other things with that kind of money.
I've become completely confused about what the voters decide and what legislators decide and why. I don't know anymore.
Basically, legislators decide nothing controversial and kick it all to voters, who then decide it, but sometimes it's unconstitutional and the Supreme Court has to come in and tell the voters that they don't understand the Constitution.
Right.
That's the shorthand. And by the way, there's a bill moving forward in Olympia now that will revise, if it passes, and it has bipartisan support, what you're allowed to put on an initiative to the people. Based on the initiative that passed about class sizes this year, which had no funding mechanism attached, this bill says if you want to propose an initiative that's going to cost money, you have to say where that money will come from. By the same token, and this is upsetting Tim Iman, if you want to propose an initiative that limits taxes, you have to say in that initiative what programs you're going to cut.
And that's because he wants to propose an initiative of some sort, probably, that is expensive and unpaid for. And that's why he's going big on this.
But that's a really important question. I mean, funding and budgets are very tricky and even subjective, whether something is paid for or not paid for, right? So that's a tough one. Should state officials be able to, so the voters say, here, we really want you to do this. State officials get to say, by our judgment, that's not adequately paid for. So we're not even going to consider it. You can't even file it.
Well,
is that right?
That's not quite it. It's that if you are going to file an initiative saying we want you to do this, you have to also say, and here's how you're going to pay for it.
But what if they say, well, you said here's how to pay for it, but we don't think that would pay for it.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know what the mechanism is for having some sort of like independent body or something that decides whether the mechanism for paying for the thing is.
Independent body meaning not the voters right. who are supposed to get to pass an initiative.
Yeah, I really think this is a bad idea.
Which is a bad idea?
This idea of initiatives being required to say how they pay for themselves. Because I think the initiative process, I mean, first of all, the Constitution doesn't require that. This would take a constitutional amendment to make that happen. The reason is that there's a tremendous number of very good laws that have passed in this state that did not have funding mechanisms, but the fact that they passed was a mandate from the voters for the legislature to figure out how to pay for the priority. And the legislature doesn't want to, partly because of its dysfunction, partly because it may disagree with the voters. The Public Disclosure Act is a great example of a fabulous law that Washington was way ahead of the curve on. And it probably would have failed. It may well have failed if you then had to put an item in there detailing how it would be paid for.
Why would that have failed? Why couldn't voters have figured out here's how to pay for it?
I'm going to disagree with you that would have failed, because that, first of all, it was actually not that expensive to have a public disclosure commission at the time that was approved by the voters by initiative. That was a really, really popular idea. They would have been able to swallow whatever that cost was. But, you know, what happened here is that everyone in Olympia, and like I said, I was there, is sort of, what in the world are we going to do about Initiative 1351? It costs so much money. And during the election, there were folks who actually had the nerve to stand there and say, you know what, this doesn't really cost much. It's sort of wrapped into the McCleary ruling. And that is really unfair and untrue, because
now the
legislature has to deal with this $6
billion
baby.
It is not unfair. That's their job, Joni.
Yes.
Their job is to figure this stuff out.
They don't
manufacture
cash.
And the fact that they don't like it, the voters have approved more than once the class size initiative. They are under an obligation to figure that out. They have to do it both because of McCleary, but because now if they have a time period in which they can diddle and not do anything about it, because you can change initiatives after a couple of years. But they have an obligation. These things, I think, are often operating principles. And I think that it ought to be very broad in terms of what can be proposed. I think liberals in particular would have trouble meeting this requirement in a way that would see passage of things like the class size initiative, which say, hey, education is a number one priority in this state.
Yeah, but you can.
I want to say I do hear some of what Knut is saying, but at first blush, I really support this movement in the legislature to require people to explain how their initiatives are going to be paid for or what they're going to cut. Because when you look at what voters have been saying, it is contradictory and incomprehensible. They want larger class sizes, better schools, better roads, more services. They don't want any income tax to help pay for it. They don't have any sense of a connection between their demands and the cost of their demands. So they just keep saying through initiative, lower our taxes and give us more goods. And that doesn't work. You can't govern that way.
And I'm sort of going to agree with part of that and tell you that, Skip, you, or Knut, I got to get that right here, you can rhapsodize all day about how much the voters loved Initiative 728, which was to reduce class size. And the legislature responded, as you said was their responsibility, by suspending it about every other week. That's what they did in response to that initiative.
Okay, so you get, this is what I want to emphasize, listener. Sometimes we say, there's a conflict over a constitutional amendment and the budgetary requirements in the initiative process, and your eyes glaze over. I told you at the very beginning of this discussion, this is really important. I mean, this has to do with what kind of say the voters have and who gets to decide whether the voters have spelled out their plans enough. And it's very interesting and very important, and we're going to keep following it. Right now, we've got more work to do because we got 25 minutes left in the week in review and lots of other interesting stuff that happened this week. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman. Bon, will you touch that red button so I can talk to you? Just briefly, I want to say, so we're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. We're always live tweeting the show at KUOW. And we've been asking listeners, we asked them about trash talking, right? Because either our general manager or a Boston station's general manager is going to have to read a list.
That is correct. So if Seattle wins the Super Bowl this weekend, the general manager of WBUR in Boston will have to read a list of reasons why Seattle is better than right. Boston on their airwaves.
Right. And this has been a license for you to be a little mean sometimes and very funny, you know, mean in a good way. It's all fun. So go to KUOW, go Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. We're going to share some of those in just a moment for you. We're going to take a break first. Come right back with a week in review. As promised, we're back with a week in review with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, and Knut Berger. Some people want more gun restrictions, but they keep bumping up against the NRA. Can we bring these two sides together with technology? This week at the Washington Athletic Club, there was a symposium on something called smart guns. Smart guns use biometric technology that links the gun to the gun owner so that nobody else can fire the thing. If somebody else tries, it doesn't work. What do you think of that, pro-gun people? Well, at the Bellevue-based gun rights group, the Second Amendment Foundation, Dave Workman said, sounds good to him.
I don't think anybody, and I've interviewed the NRA, I've talked to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, none of those organizations is against smart gun technology. In fact, they said quite the opposite. Their concern is the mandate.
Yes, he likes the technology. He doesn't want it to be mandatory. Like in New Jersey, where they have a law that says 3 years after smart gun technology is sold anywhere in America, 3 years after that, only smart guns can be sold in New Jersey.
And that's a major league problem for consumers, for Second Amendment activists. You know, the gun community just does not like being told, you got to do this.
Yeah, who likes being told that? I don't like being told you got to do this. Is this a technological solution to our gun standoff?
Well, from what I've read about it, it sounds like it could definitely save lives because, as you know, that many of the suicides that are committed in this country are used with someone else's gun. And so, absolutely, it sounds like an interesting technology. And we haven't had that fight. We just finished a different fight here on background checks. But we haven't had the fight about whether we would just sort of benefit from the technology slowly over time or whether the government would intervene. And I can tell you my prediction would be that state lawmakers wouldn't touch it. But
why?
As you like, because they don't touch gun stuff, in case you haven't noticed.
Oh, yeah. That's for the voters. I'm learning. I'm getting this straight.
Let's go. This could be, it could be an initiative because they had their success here. But the lawmakers, I don't see them touching that. Does anybody else?
Well, yeah, I agree with Joni on that. I mean, it's hard to imagine the legislature doing anything proactive about it. When I think about it, there was an item about cracking down on people using their smartphones in the car.
We're just about to get to that.
Okay.
Smart stuff.
Everyone's jumping the segue here.
I was just saying smart guns, smartphones.
Yes.
The problem is not smart people.
Right.
You know, we need smarter people.
Let's mandate that.
Yeah, let's mandate smarter people.
Eli, anything to add before we talk about smartphones and
smarter cars?
Smarter cars.
If you get cars that can drive themselves, which are coming, you can spend all the time you want on your cell phone and your smartphone apps.
Hey, okay, so let me just tell you what we're talking about here. How many of you check your phone while driving, the three of you?
Occasionally.
Knut, occasionally, which means more than he's admitting.
Yes,
more than I would like to admit.
Okay.
Not while actually driving.
No, if you're in the car, you're driving, Jody.
I know, but I'm making my distinction. Red light is different, but I don't approve of it.
The thing that gets me the worst looks is when I do it while I'm biking.
Yeah.
How about running? That off? I've done it. How about running? Yeah.
So
that's how fast I'm going.
Joni, the rules might get a lot stricter, right? Fill us in briefly.
So as you may know, that Washington was the first state to have a texting and driving law goes back to 2007. But at the time, most people were not on their phones doing Facebook and all the other things because that sort of hadn't really happened yet. And so technically and legally now in this state, if an officer stops somebody for being on their phone, as long as they're not texting and they were just like, say, buying stocks or checking the weather, those second events I just mentioned are not illegal. So this really would be an update of a law that see, we're sort of behind the other states, even though we led the other states because we did it so long ago. We didn't reflect the new technology. So that's what's before the state legislature proposed by the Washington Traffic Safety Commission.
Okay, so no emailing, no texting, no looking at your GPS. If you have it on your phone, you can't look to see where you should turn right in 500 feet, right?
Yes, but don't get so upset. You can have Siri talk to you about where you should turn, right? You just set your phone so that it speaks to you.
So this is a law.
And it could also be slapped on the dash. So it's like you're not holding it, but it's slapped right in front of you with one of those sticky things on the dash.
Okay. Well, I was about to say, when you're talking about Siri, you're talking about a law of the privileged, right? Because I'm in a 15-year-old car. This is mandating that I've got to buy stuff that I don't have. Are they going to give this to me free? The GPS on the dash that's talking to me?
I'm still in the era of struggling with the old gas station map.
How do you fold this thing?
It's like you got to fold it so you can hold it right the right way on the steering wheel while you're lost in West Seattle.
It's true that they never mandated by law that you couldn't look at a folded map while you drive.
Hey,
but plenty of people did that.
Two words, pull over, come on.
Yeah, no, there is a rule against inattentive driving, and I hate to break the news to Joni, but that includes looking at your phone while you're at a stoplight. And I don't know if anybody else has noticed, but the number of people who don't go when the light turns green because they're, I don't know.
Honk. I'm telling you.
No,
get
there's
over,
a lot more honking.
Get over your anti-honking thing. What we need is better horns, like a horn that says, it's time to go. So nobody, it's like you only have one sound, so we think it's rude to honk. It's not rude. Just tap the thing.
I think it was 1910 or something. It was very early in our car history that Seattle banned the Auga horn. The Claxton, maybe we should bring those back.
You want more of a symbol, like a light, gentle, it's time to go, and I know you're on your phone, and get
then it would get mistaken for one of your phone alerts.
Crickets.
No, we need a few messages, three or four different messages. Anyway, so you are okay with it or you're not okay with this new law?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think that because people who misbehave like I do and everyone else here, that we probably need to update some of it. Whether or not it's going to – I think the GPS is probably the one that will be the one that is the most argued over. And so in some way, fashion, because then you can argue if the person doesn't know where the heck they're going, they're causing more trouble. So I think that's the one that's the most likely, if this ever gets to be a bill, that wouldn't occur.
But how could you separate that out? Officer, I was just looking at my GPS. I wasn't looking at that thing I'm not supposed to look at. It would be unenforceable.
We're going to give you a sticky to attach it, and that's not that expensive.
Okay.
The GPS defense.
The GPS defense.
The most common defense.
That's right.
I appreciate the law for the same reason Joni expressed. Like, I violate it. You know, it's not a law now, but I do things already that aren't in my interest or the safe interest of anyone else, and I appreciate being reminded.
We all need.
No, it's not a reminder. It's a law change.
$24
bucks, you like that?
What it is?
Well,
if you like reminders like that,
I guess what I'm saying is I've been reminded plenty, so maybe I need a reminder under threat of detention.
Got it.
we deserve to have laws that we disobey every day. That's a citizen's right. Crack down on all the other drivers that do it.
There you go.
Well, Eli, you mentioned, eventually we'll have self-driving cars, and this won't be an issue, right? So how do you feel about all this groovy new technology that's going to give us all this stuff? Because worrying about technology, where it's taking us, that is the job of Luddites, pensioners, hand-wringers, Chicken Littles, and Bill Gates. This week, Gates did one of those Reddit AMA chats, Ask Me Anything, and he wrote, first, the machines will do a lot of jobs for us and not be super intelligent. That should be positive if we manage it well. A few decades after that, though, the intelligence is strong enough to be a concern. And then he adds, I don't understand why some people are not concerned. Gates mentioned that he agrees with Elon Musk, the Tesla PayPal guy who just said he's going to put a big SpaceX office in, is it Redmond, right?
Seattle.
It's going to be
in Seattle itself?
No, it's in Redmond.
Oh. Redmond.
It's in Redmond. They're going to be neighbors out there in Microsoftville.
That's right. Both worrying together, both shivering together. So Elon Musk, what he's been calling attention to is this scary book called Superintelligence, which gives the example of a superintelligent computer that we have told to make people smile. And we're thinking, hey, a computer that tells jokes. But this computer decides that the most efficient way to make people smile would be to paralyze their facial muscles into a fixed grin. And we can't stop it.
We're all like the Joker.
Yes. You know. So what did you think of Bill Gates, of all people, telling you you should be worried about where tech is going?
I'm glad he said that. The example that is closest to any work I've done that worries me is related to drones. And we had this citizen-operated drone that crashed onto the White House lawn this week, right, and caused a big problem.
Yes.
But on the military drone level, we are already seeing governments create drones and military equipment that's capable of making a decision on its own as to whether to fire a missile or not. So a kind of artificial intelligence on that score. And so you can imagine in the future, drones that are flying themselves and making decisions on their own about what to do and what threats to eliminate and so on. And that is scary.
Yeah. In fact, when this drone, did it actually crash into the White House
into
property?
A tree on the White House lawn, but it was on the White House property.
Didn't your mind go to, wait a minute, how can we stop drones plunking, weaponized drones plunking into Congress and White House, right?
Right.
That was disturbing.
Yeah. It's a problem that they haven't figured out the fix for.
So we've seen RoboCop. We've seen 2001 and HAL, the computer. I mean, I think people have been thinking about this scary technology stuff for, a long time.
Sci-fi writers, but Bill Gates,
yeah,
too,
well,
and Elon Musk, who's satellite.
So here's my
guy?
Bill Gates thing. In 1988, I actually was sitting and talking with Bill Gates about the future of computers and stuff, which, you know, was sort of like he was talking to a caveman. And I asked him the question. I said, how smart are computers going to be? And he actually had a great answer. He said, they'll tell us when they get there. and that really struck me at the time, you know, because it's sort of like, oh, yeah, it's not really up to us. They'll, you know, we'll get it started, and then at some point they'll kind of kick in, and then one day they'll say, we've reached our limit, you know, or they'll say, you are doomed, human, you know, there will be some kind of decision. But I think he's bringing up, you know, I think it's interesting because they think about big picture stuff. They think about the downside. Anything we create, anything, will be weaponized. I mean, it's just, that is the flaw of human nature. Whether it's drones, as Eli's talking about, and I totally agree with that. But I think that our creative process or impulse is not going to stop. There will be benefits that come from artificial intelligence. So I think it's good to worry about. But once we get to a place where there's a problem, I'm not sure we're going to really be able to do anything about it.
Okay. So, welcome to the Robocalypse. Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, and Joni Balter. Let's lighten up for just a moment before we take a break. We asked, as I said, we asked you on Facebook, who's better, Seattle or Boston, and why? Because the winning team there, the station on the other side of the country is going to have to read a list of why that other city's better than us. So just to give you a little taste, first of all, Anna on our Facebook page writes, we have big balls. Thank you, Anna. She's referring to the fact that the Seahawks have not been found to be deflating their footballs. Jason says, we don't have 15 feet of snow on the ground.
Exactly.
Ouch. right when they're still buried under it. John says Seattle does not have and will never have an equivalent to Bill Buckner. Ouch. That's the guy who let the Boston Red Sox first baseman who let the ball roll through his legs in the World Series. Do we not have a Bill Buckner here?
Well, we have a Mario Mendoza who set the standard for terrible baseball hitting.
That's right, below the Mendoza line.
The Mendoza line. So that's not quite Bill Buckner, but it's a symbol of perpetual losing.
We have Bertha. She's our Bill Buckner so far.
They have Big Dig.
That's true, true. Let's see. Amy says Seattle has both better coffee and better beer than Boston, which makes our populace more productive and more relaxed simultaneously. Gretchen says Harvard is considered to be the evergreen state college of the East. That's true, Knut. You're an alum.
Absolutely.
Ken says that we have far fewer Bostonians here, which makes us superior. And finally, Mary Jo says, we are nicer. I am sorry if this hurts your feelings, Boston. you could add your own here before the game happens, and we'll see whether KUOW or WBUR has to go on the air and read why the other city is better. Back in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. Told you, Joni, if you tell me to drink the whole bottle of cough syrup, I'll do it. And I just tried.
Kidding. I was kidding.
I had one of those beer bong hats with the Robitussin in it.
Put down the cough syrup.
Man, I'm doing my best. Thank you for tuning in to KOW's Week in Review. Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. Knut Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. And we're making you smart in a compressed amount of time in about what happened this week. The new 520 floating bridge is costing a lot to build. Cars have to pay a toll. Why not bikes? The head of the state Senate Transportation Committee says bicyclists should pay a toll to cross the new bridge's bike path. Republican Curtis King says somebody had to pay for the bike lane. Fair is fair. Eli, you're a bicyclist, you're going to pay, right? And
fine.
It's only fair?
Fair enough. I haven't seen how much the bike toll is supposed to be.
Less than the driving toll, that's all we know.
I would lobby for that. That seems fair. And, you know, fair is fair. If Republicans are going to start charging Seattle and Bellevue area bike commuters for using the bridge, hopefully then they'll legislate with biker interests in mind in the future. We get a lot of things allocated from Olympia that ignore the needs of bike commuters.
You know, it is almost Groundhog Day here, and we are seeing this sort of anti-Seattle, East versus West. There was even another bill introduced to divide the state into two. Seen it, Groundhog over again. Okay.
How would they enforce that?
Well, yeah, I'm trying to imagine, you know, the family out on bicycle Sunday going across the bridge, you know, and some toll taker, you know, trying to hit up the 6-year-old with training wheels. That's ridiculous.
Hey, that training wheels cost extra, man. That rips up the roadway. Okay, that's enough on that. How about this? This local brewery? I mean, this is the story. A brewery does good. Local brewery gets bought out by a beer conglomerate. Right? Rainier, Pyramid. Now it's happening to Elysian Brewing. You see Elysian on Capitol Hill. They're in downtown. There's a Green Lake. There's one in Pioneer Square. There's the new brewery, fairly new, in Georgetown. Elysian Brewery is being bought out by Anheuser-Busch. Who thinks this is a big loss?
Well, I thought that the lead of the Puget Sound Business Journal article on this sort of captured it. So in tech, when a giant tech company gobbles up another tech company, it means that the smaller tech company was doing really, really well. And,
right.
And isn't it just awesome that this happened? Not so much with beer if it involves, you know, a big conglomerate like Anheuser-Busch. So everybody here it was boohoo city here because people really like the idea of this sort of boutique Elysian, isn't it great beer? And they're just sort of fearful that Anheuser-Busch is going to do something wrong with it.
Right. A software company gets picked up. A brewer is a sellout.
Well, one of the reasons is the war over distribution, what gets sold in stores. I mean, you go into stores that only sell Coke products, Coke water, Coke pop, you know, whatever. Yep. And so I think some of the smaller guys are afraid that they're going to start using their muscle and muscling out so that options in these places will be somewhat reduced. So that's one of the fears. But the fact that the microbrews are doing so well, and the fact that our options for beer are not going to vaporize overnight for craft beer.
I think we have a lot of beer.
Yeah, we have a lot of beer. I think that's the issue. On the other hand, Anheuser-Busch makes terrible beer.
Mm-hmm.
Budweiser's awful, and its market share is declining. You know, so I guess they're trying to branch out.
Yeah, I'll just point out that Elysian Brewery has a beer called Loser Pale Ale, and the logo on the six-pack says, corporate beer still sucks.
I wonder if that'll stay.
I wonder if that's going to stick around.
Like, remember when the Boz sold anti-Boz t-shirts
yes.
in Denver to make money? Maybe this is how they can do that.
KBW's Week in Review, we're going to power to the end in just a moment. Don't go away. The Week in Review, and thank you for tuning in, and happy Friday to you. This is just a note for you travelers. You cannot go to Issaquah on Sunday, okay?
Period?
Period.
From any direction?
No, from nowhere, because it doesn't exist. On Sunday, until the Super Bowl is over, the mayor has officially changed the city's name to 12-Saquah. Officially. This is, of course, a reference to the 12th man. It's not just 12-Saquah either. All this week, the city of Hoquiam has been changed to Hoquiam by the mayor. So, through a public disclosure request, KUOW has been able to obtain a list of rejected town names. These are Washington State names that could have been altered for the Seahawks game, but the ideas have been rejected. We got it through a public disclosure request.
Yeah.
Hockletio, not going to happen.
No.
Hawkwilla? No, sure, Mamish.
What was wrong with that?
Sure, like it that. Got. We need to find out more about why that was turned down.
Yeah.
Beast Mode Clips, Forward Pasco. I think DuPont should be.
That is
should
absolutely.
Be a new the new name. It's apparently not going to be.
Do Fake Punt would be better.
Poles Bowl 49. Super Bowl 49.
You wouldn't want to win the Bulls Bowl.
And thanks to the coach, Pete Carroll, we have the options now of Pete Angelus, Pete Orchard. My favorite is Pete Townsend, and you would think that that would carry the day. It did not. Same for Rustin Wilson. C-tackled in the backfield for a loss. It's going to continue to be C-tack, which for international travelers is probably makes sense. It's very confusing.
You know, the good news is Bill has finally got the Seahawks bug.
Finally. Three more. Cortez Kennewick, Tom Waterboy, and Battleground Cannot Cause a Fumble will not be the new name. It's just going to stay Battleground.
You're sure of that?
We filed a public disclosure request and obtained that information. That's why. Okay, so last thought, can you enjoy the sunshine, or are you worried about climate change? Are you allowing yourself to enjoy this weather?
Well, you do know that the trees are about maybe 10 days to two
yes.
weeks ahead of where they're supposed to be. So.
Yeah.
We were asking the same question in our office. It's hard.
It's hard to enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, hoping for a cold snap.
Hoping for a cold snap. Well, it's going to rain on Sunday. If only we can think of something to do indoors on Sunday. I can't think of what it would be. Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, and columnist of Seattle Magazine. Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail and Bloomberg View. Eli Sanders from The Stranger. I love when you're here. Thank you.
Nice Thank to be here.
We're on Facebook, KOW Public Radio. We're tweeting at KOW. Get the podcast. Just go to iTunes or Stitcher. Go to KOW.org and get the podcast. Jason Pagano produced a great show. Thank you for tuning in.